Hi, and welcome to the first Cinetopia of 2019. I'm Paul, the director of the Edinburgh Short Film Festival, Scotland's largest dedicated short film event. We're back here now at our new home at EHFM, and we've also got a few new team members. Melina and Will have sadly moved on to pastures new, but we're obviously hoping to catch up with them a bit later in the year, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, let's introduce our new team members. First of all, we've got Jim Ross here, who is the editor and co-founder of Take One Magazine. Take One Magazine covers independent cinema and festivals globally and has done since 2010. Welcome, Jim. So tell us a little bit about what you've been up to.
So we've been covering the London Short Film Festival recently, which has some stuff from the Edinburgh Shorts Festival, actually. It's looking very good. The Glasgow Film Festival programme came out a short while ago, so I'm planning our coverage of that, and it looks like there'll be a lot of interesting stuff, so hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about it here.
Great, and we also have Annie here, who's a freelance film practitioner based in Edinburgh, originally from Helsinki, and Anna has also recently graduated from the Edinburgh University Film Exhibition and Curation Master's Degree course, so congratulations, Annie.
Thank you.
That's all right. You've also been working with film festivals internationally, and you're a programmer with Cinetopia. So what have you been up to lately then, Annie? Just
watching a lot of films.
That's good, I'm glad to hear it. And of course, as usual, we also have Amanda Rogers, who's also graduated from Edinburgh University and has been making films with RPP Productions around Scotland. Hi, Amanda, and how are you, and what have you been up to?
Hi. Yeah, so since I've moved to Scotland, I moved my video production business here, and we've made a couple really great films. One with the Scottish Council and Archives, showing archives all around Scotland, and the other one was with Colourful Heritage, which is an archive based in Glasgow.
Okay, so here we are, ready to start. We might as well crack on. There's a lot going on in the film industry and a lot to talk about, so let's get going. Well, it's Oscar season, and as usual, there's a lot of Oscar-nominated films out just now that we should look out for. So we're going to start with our reviews this week, this particular edition of Cinetopia, with a few films, one of them The Favourite, and also Scotland's big premiere this week, which was Mary, Queen of Scots. But let's start with The Favourite. So, Jim, have you got any thoughts on that film? You tell us a bit about it and what you think of it.
It's a period drama. I mean, it's not a particularly conventional one, as we'll come on to describe in a minute, but it's set during the Restoration period in Britain, in Queen Anne's court. Olivia Colman plays Queen Anne, and then beyond that, the main focus is Rachel Weisz, who plays Lady Marlborough, who was kind of like her closest confidant. I'm no historian here, so I'm sure somebody will pick me up on this over time, but basically she plays her closest confidant. And then into this scenario comes Emma Stone playing a cousin of Lady Marlborough. And basically the favourite, the title refers to kind of this kind of triangle which of power grabbing which goes on between them. I mean, basically it uses the character interactions to frame the politics of the time. So there is quite a lot of political manoeuvring going on, but it's all very much done and refracted through the lens of how those characters are interacting with one another.
So Annie, how did you find it?
Well, exactly that. So I found it very funny. It had some quirky humour that I liked. And because I'm not a fan of period pieces, I liked the fact that it was more contemporary. It could be set in any time and space, basically. There's just this loose background of Queen Anne's court, and it's more just about these three characters. And the characters are complex, they're unpredictable. That's something you rarely see from female characters. Mm-hmm. More nowadays, of course, and it's always good that you do, but in the past, less so. But yeah, I really liked it.
So how do you guys think it'll do at the Oscars then? Have you got any?
I think on the acting front, it'll do very well. There's a lot for the three main actors, so Rachel Weisz, Emma Stone, and Olivia Colman. There's a lot for them to grab onto. I mean, basically, it is a very character-driven film, which has its downside, which maybe I'll get into in a moment. But I think it'll do very well on the acting front. The director, Yorgos Lanthimos, I think he could do quite well also, but I think the main focus will be on that acting trio. I think they are very accomplished, and I think it will hoover up quite a lot of awards for them, certainly.
Yeah, I think I agree. There's really good contenders for The Favourite on the Best Picture, but yeah, I'm pretty sure that Olivia is well, I hope she's going to get an Oscar. She does an amazing job.
I'm very much rooting for Olivia Colman. I think she did probably one of the best. I'm a big Olivia Colman fan, but I think she also did an exceptional job with this. And I think that's what makes, I think the acting and the women and the story is what makes this a so much more positive Yorgos Lanthimos film than I've ever seen. You know, I mean, his other ones are quite dark and in certain aspects, you know. I mean, not that I didn't enjoy The Lobster, but I think there's something quite funny. And I'm also a big fan of period, unlike Annie, maybe a big fan of period films and historical films, but I think this one is a new take on it, and it's definitely a modern take on it, which is quite impressive to see. Unlike films, I think, in the past who've tried to be more modern, I'd love to throw my dislike of Marie Antoinette in there. But I think this film has got a way to keep you entertained and also make you understand that really the women are the main part of the story, you know?
Olivia Colman is superb, and actually what you said there about it being a slightly different take on it, I really do think it's her performance that underpins that. Because when the film opens, she is fully in comedy mode, really. I mean, I mean, honestly, you could the mannerism she's displaying and the tone that she's taking, it's like she was plucked out of Peep Show. I don't know how much Peep Show any of you have watched, but it did feel like the Sophie character there to begin with. But the range that she then goes on to display throughout the film is really quite remarkable. So this idea of balancing those interactions of the characters, the tone, and the fact that it's comedy as well laced in there, I think she's really the pillar that all rests on. I mean, the other two are superb in their own right, but basically everything revolves around Olivia Colman's character. And if she didn't pull it off as well as she had, then I don't think the rest of the film would fall into line, to be honest.
Absolutely. But I also wonder if you guys think, what do you think of that ending with the bunnies? To me, it's funny because at the end of it, it made me feel like a little bit of a David Lynch film, and that's maybe why I thought the sense of humor added to this new oeuvre of Yorgos Lanthimos, that there's kind of this weird sense, funny oddity to the way that he's filming this.
Are you going to need a spoiler here at some point? Spoiler alert.
Well, I think that I can address it without spoiling ancient history. But I think it actually plays into my only main issue with the film. This is where I'm going to digress slightly from liking it. There isn't much feeling of momentum there. Now, for most of the time that the film is on, it gets away with it because the interactions between the characters is so engaging and it's so well written. But there's not really much sense of anything actually happening. And I think maybe this actually plays a little bit into that conclusion, because how do you conclude a film like that? Right. You know, these characters in real life, I mean, they would go on to live, they still existed at the end of the film, and, you know, there's a lot of history that follows the actual period this film is depicting. And it's got these intertitles, these kind of like chapter divisions, which quote some of the dialogue. And I actually think part of the reason it's there is because there wouldn't really be much sense of progression if it wasn't. And as I say, the film gets away with it. I like the film, but I think maybe the ending plays slightly into that. If you don't have that sense of progression to the same level, then how do you conclude it? And I think that's maybe why it ends up that way.
Yeah, it's fine. I like the intertitles, but I didn't like the way they looked. I thought they really annoyed me because they were like all spread out in different shapes and stuff. And I'm picky about that.
Yeah, it was
stuff.
Almost like somebody had gone a little bit mad with the Justify button.
Exactly. It was very bizarre. Yeah. And, you know, I think we talked about this before, but I don't like the massive use of the wide angle lens, like the 8mm sort of look. It was just too, like I was watching a GoPro video or something like that. I don't know. There was just something not, it was too fake to me, or so, I don't know why he's so obsessed with that, but it wasn't my favorite element to that either.
I don't either. I mean, the super wide angle lenses, the main thing is I don't really see what it was adding to it. That I don't necessarily have an issue with the use of that. I just don't really see why it was used there. Maybe I'm missing something, but that would visually otherwise, I think it's very good. It forgoes the problem that a lot of period dramas have, where it's a very steed and, you know, still camera, let's frame everybody appropriately. It is a lot more dynamic than a lot of similar films, so it's actually quite good in that respect. But the wide angle lenses did confuse me. That was a bit irritating.
It didn't bother me at all for some reason. I didn't even really notice it that much. And there's a few theories online about it. The other one says it's like CCTV footage almost. So the whole idea is you're looking into this, and it's, I think Mark Kermode said it's like hermetically sealed world, like a little snow globe that you look into. And they're very much like, they're all, everything is just, it revolves around them. So there's this very closed world. And maybe that's something that they try to convey with the use of that, or then just a kind of new and contemporary look into to period dramas, you know, because it's a totally new look of that kind of film.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing that. Now, one film that we're going to review that doesn't need a spoiler alert is Mary, Queen of Scots, which is a big Scottish release, Scottish-based release this week. And so, guys, I'm going to ask you what you think about that. Primarily also, I don't know if any of you have seen the 1970 version with Vanessa Redfern, which is quite good. Well, Vanessa Redfern is excellent in it, but how it compares with that. But yeah, so let me know what you think of it.
Well, first of all, it annoys me that, is it Joe Alwyn is the name of the actor that's in both films? The guy who's playing the love interest in Mary, Queen of Scots of Queen Elizabeth? Isn't it the same guy that's in The Favourite as well?
All right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Why did he say yes to both films? It's just a personal thing. As a film, I like the fact that it's rewriting history in a way that is bringing these historical characters and making them very strong female characters with desire for power. But it is a period piece, and the dialogue, it's been praised for its script, and I can't go with it. Like, I said after the film, it's quite like a musical for me. So like, it takes me like half an hour to get used to that, you know, ponciness and that pompousness of dialogue. And when I do get into it, it's kind of easier. But to begin with, it's just too much. Like, I just don't like that stuff. And it didn't have much comedy either. Like, I don't expect too much, but when it's trying to take things too seriously, it kind of distances me, and I'm like, oh no, this is just stupid. Some things just didn't work with me at all. But it is very cinematic. It's very beautiful, although it does use, you know, wrong places at the wrong time when it goes to the borders, and it's actually shot in Glencoe.
All right.
Which only people who know Scotland quite
Scotland
well
know,
would probably
yeah.
care.
Yeah, I think
but we do.
I mean, I think passing off Glencoe as the border is probably a bit egregious, really. But
regional borders, yeah. People can get very up about that, you know.
But, yeah. So, in terms of I don't know how much of Scotland you haven't seen it, so I don't know how much of Scotland you've seen it. But do you think it works quite well as when you look at Scottish historical films, they very often can be quite gritty and realistic, like The Outlaw King, or they take the Hollywood approach that Braveheart took. So, which side of the equation do you think it falls on?
A little bit of both. I mean, the thing, visually, I think it is, it's quite reserved, but it is very cinematic. So the people who've brought it to the screen, Josie Rourke, the director, she comes from a theatre background. And then you've got Bo Willimon, who is a playwright, and he's probably best known to people as the writer of the House of Cards remake that Netflix did, and showrunner for that, actually. So you'd think it could end up quite theatrical, it could end up quite stagey, but to its credit, it really does not. It is, as Annie said, it's very cinematic and it's very well done in that respect. My issue with it is, it's probably a slightly different one to Annie, but it is related, and it is the dialogue. And the thing is, it frames this conflict between, I say conflict, it's more the conflict's maybe a bit strong actually, between Elizabeth I and Mary, Queen of Scots, as a sort of a power dynamic, a struggle between them over distance. And they are framed as very strong female characters. They impose themselves in situations quite well, and that aspect of it is great. The thing is, it's desperate to be seen that way. And that comes through in the dialogue. There's a lot of very overt moments which don't really sit with the flow of the film. When the thing is, the way it's scripted and the way they've done it, it would come through. The themes that it wants to present about how these two women were regarded and seen in the eyes of the men of their respective courts and even their subject would come through in the film anyway. But it's making these very, very unsubtle, trailer-ready moments which are ready to be plucked out and put into promotional material, which don't fit. And the annoying thing is they don't need to have it. If you'd put a bit more trust in the audience, then that would have come through. So in that respect, it's a little bit unfortunate. I mean, it's not breaking any period piece molds, I don't think. But it is very watchable. Again, the leads are very good. It's just that lack of subtlety that really... It actually kind of pulls you out of the film a little bit, and I don't think it would have been at the expense of the, you know, the themes coming through or anything like that. So that part of it, to me, is a little bit unfortunate.
Absolutely. I felt the same way. I mean, Annie actually and I went to see the film together, and there were just moments where I was laughing, you know, like, oh, I need a drink. And these like moments of, are you for real? Like these are the one-liners that I think maybe they're trying that same kind of brave heart, you know, we want something that will survive for 10 years that you'll be able to quote, or something that must be a reason why they were doing that. But I felt it was not, I was surprised that everyone said the script was so good, because I thought that was kind of something that frustrated me. But I do think it was probably more cinematic than I expected it to be for a theater director. It was, when you think of things like Mamma Mia, which is so like, it feels like you're watching it from a stage, you know.
I try not to think of Mamma Mia, but
I do. I enjoy Mamma Mia every once in a while, but you know, the idea that this theater director has taken like and made this so 3D is so apparent, and has used Scotland in such an amazing way in terms of filming. It's just stunning. They're saying that it's going to draw lots and lots of people to Scotland because it's such a big blockbuster. It's such an important story that people are interested in, and history. And I can see why, because I would watch this and was like quite happy that I live here, you know. And I can imagine some family in America being like, let's go to Scotland next summer and see where Mary's Queen of Scots rode her horse, which is actually Glencoe, not the Borders.
So, yeah, so I think the thing with Mary Queen of Scots, of course, has quite a large cult following as a historical figure. So that in itself is going to generate. Do you think they played fast and loose with the kind of, because these people will want, be studying this film closely to see how accurate it is in terms of the historical accuracy. So did it play fast and loose with that to gain an audience, or is it fairly faithful and... would it sacrifice, you know, cinematic elements in order to be more historically accurate, do you think?
So I think by and large, and again, I preface this with, I am no historian. Famously, my American wife's British and Scottish history is a lot better than mine in terms of knowledge. However, I think by and large, it seems quite faithful. I think you will get some naysayers, but I think that's largely because I think Mary Stuart has been pretty hard done by in the historical context. I think, you know, she's being reassessed quite a lot, and that's part of the reason this film came about. So the book, the factual book that it's based on, is very much kind of a reassessment of her legacy. So it doesn't play too fast and loose. The one standout moment, which has been mentioned a few times, is the fact that there is a scene, it's in the trailer, so this isn't really a spoiler, is there is a scene where Mary and Elizabeth meet, which of course, supposedly, as far as I'm aware and based on what I've read, did not happen in real life. Now, I don't really have a problem with that. The dramatic trajectory of the film demands that it happen, and I think it also gives the two actors a chance to bounce off each other, and it's a quite engaging scene when it gets to it. My main issue with it is it's shot like a perfume advert before that bit. It's this scene where these bed sheets hung up and it's soft light, and they kind of, you know, artfully wade their way through
them. I like
the
scene.
I did not. I thought it looked like one of those like Chanel adverts or whatever that Margot Robbie shot a while ago. That's maybe just me, but beyond that, it seems quite faithful. But in reassessing it in a modern context, which I think is a little bit more engaging and a little bit more appropriate for our time, really.
Yeah, that meeting scene is. We talked about it right after we came out the cinema, and we thought it was the most theatrical scene there is. So I could see that work on a theatre set. So like, they're thinking these two people are going to meet, they're going to be on the same stage, how do we get them not to see each other straight away? Oh, let's put down some sheets and, you know, that'll look great with the lights. So like that's something that I think is directly derived from the director's history on theatre stage. I liked it, but then again, it's an opinion stuff. Some people like it, some don't. But it is also the first time the actors meet each other in real life. So Margot Robbie was just finishing filming and Saoirse Ronan just started filming. So they hadn't seen each other in costume before that. So also the first time for them to meet.
Mm. I mean, it's quite a theatrical device to part curtains in any case, isn't it, I think?
And the fact that they don't see each other straight away, they said they're not sure if they used the first take, but the first take definitely gave a bit more emotion to the scene because it is also them seeing each other the first time. So I do understand why it's there and I do understand why they did it like that.
It's an interesting point. I think I didn't actually know that about them meeting for the first time. I think, and don't get me wrong, I didn't hate it as such. Like I didn't, you know, stand up and want to march out of the cinema or anything, but it's just, it did feel a little bit like even an extension of that symptom of wanting to make everything very obvious. And I just find it a bit unfortunate because actually I think the dialogue in that scene is some of the better written dialogue in the film. These two characters coming together for the first time and expressing, you know, treading that line between admiring each other and being, you know, very wary of each other. And that's where a lot of that gets to come to the fore. I found just the way it was shot, I found it a little bit jarring because the other thing is, it doesn't, to me, really fit in with the rest of the film. But no, I hadn't considered that. It's a very good point in terms of why it was done that way.
So, finally, would you recommend it to Edinburgh audiences, you think, Mary, Queen of Scots?
Well, of course, yeah, because it is sort of made for the Scottish people as well, part of it, and for British people equally, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I do have some reservations about it, but I don't see any reason to tell somebody not to go see it. It looks very good, it's well acted, it is very engaging. Like, sure, there are the odd bits that need a bit of extra polish, but you know, it's very rare that you come across a film where that's not the case. So, good. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, there we are. That's one film we don't have to spoil the ending for. So we'll move on now to the next part of the programme, which is going to be an interview with the actor Jamie Robson. So we are joined today by Jamie Robson, the actor who appeared in Blue Christmas, which was the film that won the Best Scottish Short Film Award at the Edinburgh Short Film Festival. So thanks for coming in to talk to us, Jamie.
My pleasure.
We're really here to talk a little bit about acting and so on, but just a little bit about the year that you had. It's been quite a big year for you.
Yes.
And there was the BAFTA award winning My Loneliness is Killing Me.
Yes.
Obviously Blue Christmas, which yes. appeared at Sundance and has also gone on to win an award in London, I believe.
Yes, and it also screened, it premiered at Toronto at TIFF and then went on to be in the competition at Sundance and Rain Dance and London Short Film Festival. Also Clermont Ferrand, which is
a well-known shorts festival. So you've also, you were in Spin's Fate, which is your first feature film.
Yes.
So that's completed now, isn't
it? Yes, it's well into post-production. It's likely to hit the festival circuit around spring.
Okay. So how did you find, you know, moving from acting in a short film to acting in a feature, and how was that different?
The scale, obviously, the budget allowed for better locations and facilities. And having to sort of digest a feature-length script was more of a challenge. And sort of understand each section or act while maintaining the through line. And the nice thing about shooting a feature is that you're in it for longer. So you've got more time to settle into the character, to develop a relationship with cast and crew, and to explore and even experiment and really tangibly feel and demonstrate the journey that the character goes through, you know, from sort of identity to essence, you know.
So do you think in a feature it's maybe easier to adjust your performance as you're making it?
Yes,
and
got
you
the
know,
time, yeah.
And you sort of add little bits of extra into the
yeah,
to characters.
Yeah, I just think that you have, I mean, especially if you have a relationship like I do with Ross A. Wilson, the director, we're very close, very collaborative. So at night we'd often maybe look at rushes or discuss the day of shooting, plan the day ahead, and make tiny adjustments to the character or to, you know. So it's the negative or the difference with features is that it's a huge wheel. It's a much bigger wheel. So with shorts, I could have been shooting one a month and maybe see it you know, 3 months later, but we shot Spin State a year ago, and it's maybe going to hit the festival circuit this spring. And, you know, a project with Charlotte Wells that we'll discuss later, maybe, we've been discussing for 2 years. A project with Mark Cousins I've been discussing for 2 years. So it's a much bigger wheel, you know, with features.
Yeah, there's a longer lead-in and so on.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of, you know, the actual year that you've had, it's been quite successful. Spin State coming out, you're obviously looking forward to that. Can you tell us a little bit about the film and
yeah,
the background?
So the script came in and I was blown away immediately. Scripts come in and there's things that you don't understand or you'd like to inquire or you'd like to maybe suggest tweaks before committing. But this script was just, it was incredible. And it was very, very well written. Ross Wilson, he's a writer-director. He's really an auteur in a sense because he has such a almost obsessive control. You know, he likes to kind of co-produce, to edit, to grade. He's very involved in sound design and things like that. He's really very much in control. And the script came in and we had a chat on the phone. I pulled into a lay-by when he rang me and we spoke for 3 hours. And the next day he came up on the train and we went actually to see a Caravaggio exhibition because we both believe in looking at other art forms to get ideas for cinema. So for lighting and composition, looking at classical art, maybe sculpture, poetry and prose for dialogue and so on.
So what is it that attracts you to scripts? I mean, is there a particular type of script that you...
A good one?
Yeah.
I mean, you're at the mercy of the material. I mean, on stage or screen, yes, you can play or tweak with the material often, but you can't change it. Even if the director said you could, you know, you could improvise, it might then offset that scene with the previous or the next scene. It starts to break it up. So you really are at the mercy of the material. And for me, it's about treating the audience with respect. And I think sometimes the work is a bit on the nose. When you read some scripts, the emotion is a bit on the nose, or it tricks the actor into playing the emotion. So you end up putting a horse costume on a horse. Mm-hmm. And when you read a sophisticated script where there's ambiguity, there's paradox, and there's space for the audience to sort of do the final edit, that interests me. I think that's more sophisticated.
So that's the kind of script you're looking for, is really something that...
subtle and sophisticated, yeah. And mm-hmm. space for everyone to take something from. If it's too fixed, if it's too coloured in right to the edges and very sort of blocky, there's not much anyone can do apart from watch it, and that's a very kind of passive role for everyone, even the actors or the audience.
So, I was reading that you moved down to London.
I'm based there a lot more. Mm. I was 50-50 and now I'm a lot more. I would say 70-30, yeah, 70-30 at least.
So. Do you find that was a big advantage? I mean,
no, not at all. The way I work, I'm not really looking for work or applying for work or maybe what's known as a kind of jobbing performer. I tend to pick my work very carefully, not because I'm famous, not because I have some financial security. I have the opposite. You know, live very humbly, but in doing so, it allows me to say no, because I think it's important that you pick your canvas carefully, because if the material is bad, then there's nothing you can do, and suddenly you're stuck. You're committed legally to a project that is not going to be satisfying or enjoyable, or could be detrimental to your reputation. And it's a very intimate thing to work on a feature film, you know, with the director, the writer, the cast, the crew. So I prefer to pick my work carefully, and that has done me very well in shorts, in stage, in shorts, and now in features. I turned down 2 features before taking Spin State, and I'm very proud of Spin State. And so moving to London really hasn't changed anything.
Do you think, I mean, for other actors out there that might be considering doing that, do you think that obviously the advantages are fairly obvious,
yeah.
But what about the drawbacks, do you think?
I mean, you're in a bigger pond, so there's more competition. It's harder to stand out and gain attention from casting directors or producers or writer directors. It's more expensive to live. I don't really consider myself part of the Scottish scene. I never really did. I think of myself much more as just an international or actor, or at least European. I haven't worked in the States really, but I've worked with French directors, Turkish filmmakers. I'm a big fan of Turkish cinema, particularly in the 80s. So, I mean, London, for me, was just circumstantial. I know lots of people down there, my agent's down there. I am down there a lot for meetings, but I didn't go down there to try and find new work. And if another actor thinks of doing that, fine, but it isn't a cheap place to live, and there's a lot of competition.
So. Oh, absolutely. So now you've got some plans coming up for projects coming up.
Well, there's a few features in development or tipping into pre-production. Some have partial funding. The first one that's most likely to be shot is Things They Tell Us, which is a debut feature by Peter Marsden. Now, Peter Marsden actually used to be based at Summer Hall in the Lucky Me studio. He's an award-winning music video director. He's worked with Vice, Dazed, Nowness, Apple. And he did his debut short 2 years ago, 2016, called Not Required Back. And we used some incredible footage of that oil rig. Remember the oil rig that washed up?
Oh, yeah.
So it reminded us of the end of Planet of the Apes. We made that film together on a very low budget, and it had its world premiere at the BFI Film Festival. And then it did some good festival screenings and got some nice reviews. So his first debut feature we're developing and writing together.
What is it you think that makes Scotland particularly cinematic? I mean, is there something about the landscape and the people?
Well, obviously it's very beautiful. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of unspoiled landscape for external shots and maybe period films as well, castles and ruins and country houses and things. So it's great for that stuff. It's a great access point to the rest of Europe. The subsidies from the government. There's a strong community of crew up here, very talented crew that I hope if foreign shoots come, they make use of. I think that there should be a law or certainly some responsibility placed on international projects coming here, and they should take a vast percentage of the crew building from the local area. Scotland's got it all happening. It's a fantastic place. It's got a rich history, you know, it's the birthplace of the Enlightenment, you know, and it's very liberal, you know, and it's
there's quite a lot of literature yet to be explored in film, even.
Very much so. And the Scottish industry's got a lot of potential. I think it's doing well with big budget. International projects like The Avengers, Mary Queen of Scots, sort of semi-international, semi-cooperative films like Outlander or series like Outlander and Outlaw King, but also really low budget, completely independent, thought-provoking, you know, experimental, alternative filmmaking is what's missing.
I think that's, you know, a lot of, you know, major film industries have that as your kind of base to build on, you know, and I think that would be a good thing.
I'd like to see more young David Lynch's, Jim Jarmusch, Maya Deren, Agnes Varda, you know, the next Mark Cousins, or more Mark Cousins, and I see that in the cinema more regularly. You know, so.
Well, we can only hope that comes about. Well, okay, Jamie, thanks for coming along.
Thanks
nice
again.
To speak to you. Good luck with the films.
Cheers,
we look forward to seeing them, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you very much.
So it's Oscar season again, and a few of the shorts nominated for Short Film Oscars this year were screened at the Edinburgh Short Film Festival last year, including Fauve by Jeremy Comte and Late Afternoon by Louise Bagnall. Late Afternoon's an animated Irish animation about a woman remembering her past, a woman suffering from Alzheimer's who's remembering her past. And Fauve is a very dark drama about the lives of two young kids playing in Canada, in Quebec. So let's also now move on to the predictions that we have in mind for the Oscars this year. You got any idea who's going to win or who you'd put money on, Jim?
I mean, a few. I think the acting ones are fairly... I think Glenn Close for The Wife is pretty nailed on for Best Actress.
Oh, okay.
So I would definitely put that on. In terms of Best Picture, I'm looking at the list right now. I really have no idea, to be perfectly honest with you. It is quite a diverse list. I'm a little bit surprised Black Panther actually made it on. But then again, they did create this whole new award for Black Panther and then canned it once everybody decided it was a terrible, terrible idea. So in that respect, maybe it's not that surprising. But for me, I think I'm very pleased to see that Black Klansman has got a lot of recognition. That would be a film that would be quite easy for the Academy to ignore for various reasons. I mean, beyond that, also it came out a while ago now. But I'm pleased to see that that's got as much recognition as it has. Beyond that, I think it's the ones that a lot of people expected to show up. Roma, I think, is up there. The Favourite, we've already spoken about. That's all there. In terms of predictions, I would expect to go with the number of nominations. I think they'll probably get the most awards. Specific ones for Best Picture, I don't really know. I don't know if anybody else has got something they think is nailed on.
I think it's going to be a hard one, to be honest. I haven't seen Vice, and I haven't seen Green Book, and it seems like Green Book took a lot at Golden Globes, but then is kind of somewhat controversial from what I'm reading. I just am shocked by Bohemian Rhapsody, to be honest. I think it's like a fun movie. I quite enjoyed it. I love listening to Queen music, you know, not secretly. And Rami Malek was good, but I just, that film was not good in any sense. It was fun, but it and even the live aid scene that everyone's talking about is like they recreated it digitally or whatnot. It looked fake to me. So I just don't know. I really liked BlacKkKlansman. I really liked Roma. I really liked Black Panther. So, you know, they're different. They're diverse.
They're very different films, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think from what I've seen, Roma looks like quite a hot favourite, given the amount of publicity it's had.
Yeah, except it's in Spanish. So, I mean, that's like probably the first. I mean, I know The Artist won, and it was a silent French film. But is there another foreign language film that's ever won an Oscar?
I can't think of one off the top of my head. Yeah. I'm sure maybe we'll have comments coming and say, how could you possibly have forgotten this? How dare you? But by and large, no. And I'm not going to go into The Artist because I hated it and it basically has the plot of Anchorman, but let's not get into that right now. But historically, that's why there is best foreign language film. There's a whole bunch of films that have been relegated to that category over the years. You know, Cold War is nominated in that category this year, which, you know, it's been sweeping the boards in kind of the European awards. Shoplifters is in there. I'm pleased to see that. That is a beautiful film. Really, really great. But these are the things that don't make it in. This is why I'm surprised that Roma has made it in, because it has the twin problems, inverted commas, of being in a foreign language, but also being a Netflix film, which is a bit of a controversial topic insofar as, you know, awards and theatrical distribution goes anyway. So in that respect, it's done very well, and I think that's maybe a testament to how good the film actually is. But whether it will actually win in the end, I mean, that's another step up, I think. But
I hope the reason it's there is because it's going to win. Because I really hope it's going to win. It would really deserve the Oscar. The Favourite, another one I wouldn't mind winning. Green Book, like everyone else in here, I don't think anyone's seen it, but it sounds interesting. I'm not rooting for BlacKkKlansman, even though it has a Finn in it. Black Panther, supposedly good, but yeah, not really fitting within this category, it's in maybe, with the other films. But then again, you know, it's good that, like you said, Amanda, it's a very diverse selection of films, so that's good to see.
I mean, not to wrench us off topic, but I mean, this is basically my issue with the Oscars. I'm not saying that any film in that category is a bad film. It sounds like, well, actually, is Vice up for Best Picture?
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Vice should not be there. I'm sorry. I enjoyed it in the same way that I enjoy watching Alec Baldwin's impression of Donald Trump on Saturday Night Live, which is not to denigrate Christian Bale's performance. That's very good, but it's not in that sort of category of film. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at the vast range of films that are screened over the course of the year, they are not the best films there. It doesn't mean they're bad, but there's always one. There's always one that makes it in, which is not that great. I think this year would be Bohemian Rhapsody. In previous years, you've had things like Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. That was not a good film. I didn't like The Artist. That's maybe a more subjective opinion. But the fact of the matter is, there are a lot of films which do not make it in, which are very good. And that doesn't mean that they are irrelevant as awards, but it's more, I find it strange that people talk about Oscar snubs and things like this when there's so many films come out every year, so many wonderful films that never even get a look in for these things.
I mean, I think, you know, Spike Lee was saying there that they've diversified the Academy Award members that elect nominations, and that might have had an impact perhaps on maybe the range, the, you know, there's a greater range of film types, so I wonder if that's had an impact on the nominations, do you think?
I think it has the Best Picture, yeah.
Well, it definitely hasn't for Best Director, by any means. This is the year after Oscar's So White and Oscar's So Male, there still is all these amazing women directors that have shown great films. You know, Lynn Ramsey, one of our Scottish ones, no women directors nominated. I think it's quite frustrating for a lot of people, from what I've heard, and myself, you know, that it still don't, it doesn't seem to come up. So bothers me a bit.
The Lynn Ramsey thing really bothers me, actually. At the same time, I'm not surprised by it. She doesn't really make films that are particularly Oscar-friendly. But in terms of a directorial achievement, You Were Never Really Here was a fantastic film. Not an easy one. I'm not even necessarily sure I'd want to watch it again, to be perfectly honest. But it's really great, and I think, given some of the strides they'd made to try and diversify the offerings in the nominations a little bit, it is a little disappointing. And I think Amanda says quite rightly, I think the Best Director category this year leads that disappointment, to be perfectly honest.
Great. Oh, well, so not many clues there for me to go down at the bookies with, but
we'll keep at it next time.
But maybe next time. Great. Okay, so thanks for that, kids. We'll move on to the next subject, which is the Glasgow Film Festival programme, which has very recently been released. Is there anything that's caught your eye there and that you'd perhaps recommend for people to go and see?
Well, me and Amanda saw Aquarella in in IDFA in Amsterdam, and we saw it in a similar screening, or same screening actually, that they have in Glasgow as the Dolby Atmos screening. And it's an interesting film. It's very atmospheric, so being in Dolby Atmos is a good choice. It's got a really interesting musical score, again made by a Finn. But the cinematography is absolutely beautiful, and the beginning of the film is super strong. The rest of it is more mellow. There's a lot of just footage of icebergs, but it's a very, very beautiful film, very cinematic. And
mellow? How about a big storm?
I can't remember the storm. This is which I remember the beginning of the film because it's very strong, and the ending.
If you're looking for a very talky film, this is not it.
This is not. They don't speak, and there's no plot whatsoever. So like, we just go from one place to another around the world. It's all about a theme of water, and we go from Antarctica, I think. We go over to somewhere mid-Atlantic on a sailboat, and it's just observing humans interacting with water, or just water as an element.
So it's almost like an experimental film or a poetic film.
Well, it's Viktor Kosakowski film, so like, that should tell you something. It's not really experimental in a way. It's observational, but it has a very distinctive Kosakowski style, I think.
And it's produced by a local producer, so exactly. The production company is Scottish, and quite amazing woman who produced this, and they spent many, many years and a lot of time and a lot of danger. When you watch this, you're like literally in a storm in the sea or in a hurricane, but it's really like artistic. It's quite a stunning experience. So when people talk about cinema being an experience, it's not heavy-handed in that way of not, you know, it's talking about environmental issues, and it makes you realize how powerful and water is, but it doesn't another Al Gore film that tells you, you know, that we're destroying the environment. And that's, in that sense, it shows you how powerful and how beautiful water can be. So we highly recommend it, or I do at least.
Yeah, I do as well. It's going to be on Friday, 22nd of February at 3 p.m. in Cineworld in Glasgow.
Is there anything else that catches your eye, Jim?
I mean, a couple of things. It is a very large programme. I'm still digesting it, to be perfectly honest. A film I haven't actually seen, but there's a film called Happy as Lazaro, which has popped up in a couple of festivals in England. So it screened at the Cambridge Film Festival, where we had quite a lot of people, and also at Brighton. And I must admit, I don't know too much about the film, but I will probably try and go see it, because it seems to be highly recommended by just about anybody that I talk to. Beyond that, really, I'm just going to take a random selection. The Glasgow Film Festival, based on last year's a film festival, I'm very willing to place my faith in. It was one of the best festivals that I went to last year, and pretty much across the board, even, you know, let's be honest, there was a couple of films I picked where I wasn't as taken with them, but they were all interesting films, and some of the best films of last year that I saw at film festivals popped up at Glasgow Film Festival. So really, I would encourage folk to just get the programme, go through it, pick a few things, and really just take a dip. I think it really captured the spirit of what a film festival should be about, and that is basically why I'd leave it. I would say that.
Great. Okay, well, we'll certainly look forward to the Glasgow Film Festival, which is starting on the early in February, isn't it?
20th of February?
20th, yep. Okay. So, yeah, so we'll look forward to that. So, Amanda here was recently part of a debate panel at the This Way Up conference, which discussed a topic which has caused us to have sparked some conversations here. So, Amanda, do you want to tell us a little bit about what you talked about there?
Yeah, so This Way Up is a UK-based film exhibition innovation conference. So it brings together people from, you know, all over the UK to talk about subjects, you know, that are affecting exhibition. And one of the things that seemed to spark a lot of debate during our early talks about the conference is how we police, you know, cinema spaces. So, you know, and we created this topic called is the silent cinema audience outdated? Because there's a lot of things we have to think about in terms of, you know, people, some people are louder in spaces than others and you know, and whatnot. So I'm a big fan of popcorn and munching on popcorn and munching on nachos and slurping sodas, but I do realize that I come from an American background, which is sort of standard. And since I moved here, you know, I've been to a lot of cinemas where that is terribly forbidden in certain spaces. You know, but then that is the case in other spaces. So I thought I'd ask you guys all what you think about what cinema exhibitors should do in terms of the noisy or distracting audience members.
Guys, do you want to go first and tell me what your opinion is about? Is the cinema a sacred space?
Sacred space is maybe a little strong, right? I don't subscribe to the idea that, you know, everybody should sit in silent worship of what is on the screen. However, there is an element of, unless what is happening is a spontaneous reaction to the film, I am kind of the opinion of, no, be quiet. Now, I don't actually really include munching on popcorn here, you know. I mean, the actual, like, you know, the actions of somebody like munching on something, that doesn't particularly bother me. You know, if you're going to sit down in a darkened space for 2 hours, I don't think you can realistically expect people to not want a snack or a drink or something. But if it's your own impromptu director's commentary on the film, which happens more often than not in films, I find, particularly if you're going to a multiplex, it doesn't necessarily happen in, you know, the kind of the smaller independent cinemas, but certainly multiplex is going to watch blockbusters. I find it happens a lot, and it really irritates me. It does really irritate me, to be honest.
Annie, what do you think? Are you perturbed?
Well, I'm on Amanda's side with popcorn, but I would ban nachos on cinemas, but not because of the sound. The sounds don't really bother me that much. What bothers me with nachos is the smell. There's some snacks that are, you know, okay, because they don't stink, and there's some stuff you just shouldn't bring into a closed space. Also, don't wear perfume if you go to see a film. But in terms of like people talking, that kind of does annoy me as well, to be honest. Like and glares from phones. That's another thing. So if you look at your phone during a screening and there's a glare, it kind of takes your attention away. But also at the same time, I know I am I'm bad at watching films in a way that I tend to distance myself from the screen very many times during the film. So if I'm watching something, I know some people are like fully immersed in it, whereby myself, I don't know if it's my attention span or if it's because of my film education, but I tend to kind of take a step back and think, oh, I'm watching a film, what is this film trying to do to me and tell me? Or like a random thought, like, oh, Saoirse Ronan lives in Dublin, right? Where does she live again? You know, so like it's, I'm constantly kind of snapping away from that, you know, black box of just concentrating on the screen. So if there is a slight annoyance around me, it doesn't bother me as much as it might bother some other people. But, you know, it's annoying when there's some besserwisser around just talking about film. They know, they think they know more about it, or they comment on everything that happens. That's just something that you should know not to do.
I think, yeah, one of the questions that was brought up a lot is whether or not it's the responsibility of the cinema to police this kind of behavior, and how does one do that for the whole collective, you know? And for me, that's where I sort of stand in the fact that if they don't tell people kindly to be quiet, then there's a potential that they could disturb the entire audience. On the other hand, if they're going around and kicking you out for doing something, then there's a sense of unwelcome, like, exclusivity to the space that makes me feel like I wouldn't come back, and we're trying to get people into the cinema, you know?
Yeah, so. An absolute worst case that I had experienced was in Vue here in Edinburgh, where a person that works in the cinema came in to the screen twice during the film to check something, probably that no one's recording on their phones or being quiet or something, and they have a high-vis vest, and they walk in, and everybody can see them walking in. Like, it's, why would you do that? So if you're policing something like sound, how would you do that? How, if it's enough to tell people you're not supposed to do something, just don't talk, don't look at your phone, fine. If they decide to do so, it's their, you know, bad mannerism, basically. So
I think, you know, from my point of view, I think I don't really mind people sucking on boiled sweets, you know, I mean, the smell of nachos would probably make me want to go and buy nachos.
That's disgusting.
I quite like nachos.
It's just like smelling boiled, fried vegetables.
I think, you know, the worst thing is, I think there's worse things than that. If somebody puts their feet up on a seat, then undoes their shoelaces and takes their shoes off, you know, that's worse than nachos, you know, frankly. And I think that's an executionable offence, I think. But
The thing is, right, in terms of whether a cinema, whether an exhibitor should police this, there's different variations of it. I mean, there's the active policing, if you like, which would be the whole an usher coming in a high-vis vest to, you know, just look at whether people are recording or not. And I think ideally, if that could be done in a way that wasn't quite so ridiculously disruptive, that would be something to do. Not every cinema can do that, and I think that's an important thing to note. However, there are certain passive things that could be done, and I think they could be done better. So, for instance, I find certain cinema chains are far better at telling people to turn off their phones. There are certain chains where they make a real big thing of it. There are others where they don't. And in all honesty, I do notice the difference. I do see more phones lighting up the audience, like there's a lighthouse in the middle of it, in these places where that not more is made of that. And I think it's because people don't like to be told what to do. And I have noticed over time, I think there's a certain sense of entitlement that people have when they're going to the cinema now, in terms of, I own this space. And if the question is, should cinemas police it, then maybe to an extent, but in a more passive way like that, it's really down to people to understand that this is a public space. And I'm not saying that, you know, nobody should be offended in the public space. I don't think that's the correct thing to say. But it's more, you don't own this space. There are other people who are trying to derive enjoyment from this. Therefore, you're not going to get everything you want out of it. You don't get to, you know, rustle a bag for 15 minutes solid, right? If you can't open the bag, don't take it in. And it's just, there are certain things that could be done more, but it is really down to people to self-police it, I think, whilst keeping it inclusive to a degree, because you don't want to be too demanding of people's behavior. I don't think that would be fair.
I mean, I've seen certain theaters of people who go around the first 5 minutes pushing and telling people to, you know, to turn off their phones and stuff, and that's made me feel uncomfortable, because I'm afraid they're gonna, you know, notice when my watch or something like lights up or something like that. And I also have had people tell me to, you know, stop rustling my nut bag and stuff like that, which I, you know, was members of the audience or whatever. But you know, it happens, and I think if people don't want to go out with a bunch of people around them, then they have the space in their house to do that. But on the other hand, we need to consider the fact that if a place is too loud or too boisterous and you're paying a certain amount of money, you're not enjoying the experience that you paid for as well. So like there is a happy medium between that.
I kind of like the fact that there's two parts. So it's an entertainment and how people like to entertain themselves. So some people like to be a bit more laid back, have a few snacks, talk with their friends while they're watching a film. But luckily, the context is different, usually in cinemas that are more art house and have more like independent films that people might not see as spaces where you go and, you know, spend time with your friends and talk and have a good time. But instead you go there to see a film and you go there to enjoy a film. So I like that there's different kind of theaters, so there's different options. So if you just want to go for something like light-minded, go into Cineworld or View. And if you want to get something like an actual filmic experience, or you want to enjoy like the art of film, you go to places like Film House, for example. I just wish that there would be a bit more crossover between the two types of cinema, so like that View and Cineworld would also have that artistic side, because there's also the audience in there. Because I usually, when I go to View, I see exactly this. So I see nachos, I see people rustling bags, talking to their friends. But when I went to see The Favourite in there, I was the most noisiest person in the screen, and there was maybe like 40 of us. And then again, in Film House, the fact that they don't sell popcorn, okay, fair enough, maybe that makes it a bit more kind of some artistic experience. But then, you know, some film, there should be a bit more, I don't know, how do I say it, but like a bit more. Some of the films that are in Film House should also be in View. Some of the films that are in View might also work in Film House as well. So a bit more kind of relaxation, you know, on the rules that there is, maybe.
I think there's different cultures around different cinemas, you know, to some extent. I remember the Cameo used to show the Rocky Horror Show, and you were encouraged to come along with rice and shout at the screen and so on, which doesn't seem to be happening much with cult movies these days. But
That's the whole other thing. That's the audience participation thing. Yeah, that you have to clean the screen for 4 hours after that. So.
But it is a bit of fun to have, you know, a Rocky Horror call and response, or a, you know, great Showman Mamma Mia sing along. You know, like those are different experiences, and I think maybe at the right place in the right time, these things can happen.
I think it's good to have those sort of screenings, and there are certain films that invite that sort of thing, and I think it's great there is that sort of thing. Also these screenings where, you know, the reduced sound is used so people can go in with their young children, autism friendly screenings, all these sort of things are all good things. I think what needs to be avoided is basically us going down for your standard showing in a multiplex theatre, it basically becoming impossible to watch the film. So I've been to the cinema in a couple of places in the Middle East. So I've been in the United Arab Emirates, and I've been to the cinema in Kuwait. And when I got back home, I went to see the film again, because it is impossible. In fact, in the United Arab Emirates, I left. I walked out. And I left the screening in Kuwait, rather, because it was impossible to really get anything into the film. People were on their phones, talking, there was food getting thrown around in really? One case. And, I mean, not a food fight, more just kind of, you know, it's just people messing around. And it's there needs to be a certain level of respect for what you're watching, even if it is a, you know, reasonably disposable piece of cinematic fluff. There are people there to watch it.
You weren't chucking nachos around, were they? That would...
No, they weren't chucking naturals, fortunately, or I think I probably wouldn't have gone in the first place. But I think that's the route you want to avoid going down. And there are places where that is the case. And I find it a little bit sad. And in some cases, they don't have the alternative cinemas. Is the other thing. They don't have things like Filmhouse. They don't have things like Cameo. A lot of them don't even have anything like, say, the Dominion in Edinburgh as well. So I think that's what wants to be avoided. And unfortunately, that's kind of the trajectory I see. That's what worries me.
Great. Well, this is clearly a debate that will run and run. We'll revisit this, I dare say, in due course. So, many things coming up next month in film. The Sundance Film Festival is underway, Berlinale is coming up, and the Glasgow Film Festival, obviously, we talked about earlier. A few other things that are happening in Edinburgh. Obviously, the Edinburgh Short Film Festival is now open for entries, and we're also helping out at Manipulate. We'll be programming an animation short film program there, including Late Afternoon, which is up for an Oscar. Anna here, will you tell us what you're doing at Manipulate? You're doing something there, aren't you?
Well, one of our films, one of our projects is there. So we did this exhibition about a year ago here in Edinburgh, Centre for Research Collections in University of Edinburgh, where we were studying on Earth these boxes of films and images from this guy called Eric Lucy. And he was a filmmaker pioneer and film scientist pioneer, basically. He worked in the animal behavioral department, and he used film form to do research on animal behavior, plant growth. He did some experimentation with lights, mirrors, stuff like that. And he left behind him just boxes full of films. And we watched through the ones that were available for us. And these are not just scientific pieces, they're artistic pieces as well. They're visual, they're very, very nice. So we compiled, or Becca Selby heard from our course, compiled together a 15-minute film office footage, and we commissioned spoken word poetry and live music to go with it, and we did that here in Assembly Rocks in Edinburgh. And then that took off to Edinburgh International Film Festival, where Tinderbox was doing the live score to it, and now it's in Manipulate Film Festival,
puppet and
visual theatre, public train animation.
Yeah, absolutely.
But do you know when it's on then?
Yeah, it's February 9th at,
February the 9th, yeah. There we are. And that's actually the same date we're doing the animation screening. So,
yeah, good. I think
so is
a
that
lot
the Traverse,
of,
is it?
Yeah, it's Traverse too.
We're at the Traverse.
And
you're
I think
at Traverse.
There's a lot of the film events are happening that day.
Yeah.
So if you're film inspired, check out their website.
Great. We had Simon Hart on to chat a bit last year. I think he's a bit busy this year. But hopefully we'll maybe catch something while we're there.
Yeah, hopefully.
With a bit of luck. And yeah, look forward to that. So I think that's it for January on Cinetopia. Thanks to Jamie Robson for coming along and to Nina Halton for curating the music throughout the show. We'll be hoping to catch up next month when we'll be back with covering more film festivals, film events and reviews. So thanks for listening in. The Cinetopia radio show is produced by Amanda Rogers, co-founder of Cinetopia and RPP Productions, hosted by myself, Paul Bruce, the director of the Edinburgh Short Film Festival, and Jim Ross, managing editor of Take One magazine, as well as Annie Asikainen, co-founder of Cinetopia. And the music's curated by Nina Halton. For more information about Cinetopia and our partners, go to cinetopiashow.com or follow us on social media at Cinetopia Show. That's all for this month. We'll look forward to seeing you next month. Thank you and goodbye.
Thanks, bye.
Bye.